Good morning. I just want to make a brief note about my lecture style. Okay, I'll speak louder. Can you hear me? Okay, can you hear me? Okay. Just want to describe briefly my lecture style. Living for 4 years in Philadelphia in a particular type of community, I developed a lecture style which I call... Okay. I'm really not used to speaking into a microphone. I usually speak on Shabbat. So this is very new for me. I apologize. Okay. Again, living in Philadelphia for 4 years in a particular type of community, I developed a lecture style which I call simultaneous translation, which means that every Hebrew word I use, I try to translate into English. And this is because I'd like to make no assumptions as to people's backgrounds, and I like Torah to be accessible to everybody so that everybody can understand it. I tell you this by way of introduction because for those of you who have a strong background, please don't be irritated by the style. Please don't think that I suffer from repetition disorder, but it's a conscious decision that I've made so that everyone can feel included in the Torah that we learn. Now, that being said, you will see this rather daunting source sheet with all Hebrew language sources. Another thing I'm not used to, I'm used to really having English translations as well, but I will translate everything to the best of my ability. Okay. The period of Sfirat HaOmer, we know, is halachically a period of avelos. It has a status of avelos, of mourning. Now, this period of time that connects Pesach to Shavuot historically makes sense. There was a sort of incubation period for the Jewish people after they were released from 2 centuries of slavery, before they were zocha, before they were meritorious to receive the Torah. They needed sort of this cooling down period and this prep period. It also makes sense agriculturally. We are changing seasons from one sort of harvest to the next sort of harvest, the barley harvest on Pesach and the wheat harvest on Shavuot. But the concept of the avela is not so easily connected to the concept of Shavuot. So today what I'd like to do is I'd like to draw a connection to show you how historically the avela that was set in motion by Chazal really does have a lot to do with Shavuot per se. And though it might seem contradictory that our countdown toward Matan Torah, toward the receiving of the Torah, should sort of be characterized by avelos, by elements of mourning, nevertheless, there is a very deep and fundamental connection. And we will draw this connection through the example of Ruth, the main character in the Megillas Ruth story, and the students of Rabbi Akiva. So if you look at the first source from the Shulchan Aruch, this is just establishing that the time of Sira is a time of avelos. Nohagim shaloli sa'isha ben Pesach la'atzeret ad lag ba'omer. We are nohag that we do not get married during Sfirat HaOmer. That is a symbol of avelos. Okay. Mipnei shaba'oso zman meisu tamidei Rabbi Akiva. Why? Because in that time period, in the time period of Sfirah, the students of Rabbi Akiva passed away. Look at source number 2, the Talmud Bavli. I don't have a copy of what you have, so I don't know if it's highlighted. Thank you. It's not. That's okay. 1, 2, 3, third line down on the left, you'll see Amru, 12,000 elef zugim talmidim hayu lo l'Rabbi Akiva. There were 12,000 pairs who were the students of Rabbi Akiva. Skip those two words. Those are just two locations where they were located. V'kulan mesu v'perek echad mipnei shelo nahagu kavod ze lazeh. And all of them died in a plague at one time. Why? Mipnei shelo nahagu kavod ze lazeh. They were lacking in kavod habriyos, in basic respect toward their fellow man. So all of the great Torah that these Talmidim of Rabbi Akiva was learning was essentially worthless to them. It didn't allow them to be zocha to much other than to death. Why? Because they were lacking in this Binazam Chaviro, these mitzvot Binazam Chaviro, practicing mitzvot and making important the mitzvot of man to man. So their Binazam L'makom, their learning of Torah, was clearly very chashuv. The Talmidim of Rabbi Akiva, they were not Sam, they were great Talmidei Chachamim, they were not just little students. But it was worthless, and they died of a plague, because in fact, they were not nice to one another. Now, Ruth, we know, is the paragon of Chesed. We know that Ruth's entire life, her story that is presented to us in these four short chapters of Megillas Ruth, it's kulo Chesed. It's entirely a book, a recounting of Chesed, of devotion, of dedication. Look at source number 3. The Medrash in Ruth Rabbah tells us, Amar Rav Zeira. Rav Zeira says, HaMegillah hazot, Ein ba lo tama v'lo tahara, lo iser v'lo heter, v'lo nechtiva, ela l'lamedcha, kama matan tzchar tov v'gom le'chasadim. Rav Zeira says, the entire work of Megillas Ruth was written not to teach us lessons of tuma and tahara, of iser v'heter. There is no halachic content to this sefer per se, but rather the entire Megillah is written to tell us how great was the reward for being a gomel chesed, for being someone who dedicates your life to chesed. Now let's just review for a moment. What was Ruth's reward? Her reward was for dedicating herself to Naomi, for abandoning her own life, her own home. What was her reward? She moves from being Ruth HaMoavia, Ruth, the Moabite princess, the Moabite girl, the Nachriya, the guy, in short, to Ruth, Ima Shel Malchus, the mother of royalty. She becomes the grandmother of David HaMelech. And not just the immediate, within a couple generations, reward of becoming the grandmother of David HaMelech, but more eternally, more significantly, Ima Shel Malchus, Beit HaMashiach. She becomes the mother of royalty of the Messiah to come. So, how in these four short chapters, what we must necessarily ask, considering how great and tremendous this reward was for her acts of chesed and devotion, we must therefore go back to the text and analyze what taka was so great about her chesed. Okay, there are certain words that are not translatable. Taka, there's no English translation for the word taka. Okay, so I will translate it for you. What indeed was so terrific about, you got me. Okay. What was so astonishing about Ruth's acts of chesed that she is meritorious of such rewards? Okay. Let us engage in a deeper analysis of the text in order to yield this answer. As I was saying right before the question, I do teach Tehillim and Megillot at Thoreau College, and I'm working actually with a woman right now. It's an independent study on Megillot, and she has no background. She went to public school. She has no background. This is the first time that she is reading the Megillot, and it's a phenomenal experience for me to be able to learn with her, because she has fresh eyes and she has an excellent perspective on things that I was reared with since I was born, so I don't question these things. So she put this question to me. She says, not with Taka, but she says, what is so great about what this girl did? Every single person in this room right now has helped an old lady cross the street. Every single one of us has done chesed for someone in a position of need. What is so astonishing about Ruth's accomplishments? Okay. Let us read in Ruth, Perek Aleph, source number 4. I'll paraphrase the first few psukim. Basically, this is after the death of Elimelech, Naomi's husband, after the death of her two sons, Mahlon and Kilion. Essentially, Naomi is left bereft of everything. Okay? She says in the text, in these first few psukim, I have no hope. Ainli tikva, basically, is what she says. She calls herself bitterness. She uses very, very strong language that communicates without a doubt where she is psychologically and emotionally right now. I am a broken woman. I have nothing left. And basically, she wants to dissuade her daughters-in-law from accompanying her back to Israel. And so, we open our action here, Pasuk Yud Dalet. This is bolded, I think, for you. Vatisena kolan vatifkena, and they raised their voices and they cried. Vatifkena od, and they cried some more. Vatishak arpa lachamosa varus davka bo. So Arpa is convinced. She kisses her mother-in-law and she decides, I'm going back to my former life. But varus davka ba. But Ruth cleaves, sticks to Naomi. Vatomer hine sava yivimtech alama, shava yivimtech alama, ve elohaha, shuvi achare yivimtech. And Naomi says to Ruth, cut it out, stop it, you better go back. Just go back to your God, go back to your land, don't stick with me, I've got nothing for you. Pasuk says Zion, Vatomer Ruth, and Ruth says, and this is the most famous line from this Megillah, one of the most famous lines from all of Torah, and of course one of the most magnificent psukim from all of Torah. Vatomer Ruth, al tifki'i bi, do not nudge me anymore. Do not continue to urge me, la'azich, to leave you, la'shuv me'achareich, to stop pursuing you, to stop following you. Ki el asher telchi eleich, because where you go, I will go. Uva asher talini alin, where you sleep, I will sleep. Amech ami, your nation is my nation. Velokayach elokai, and your God is my God. The ultimate declaration of the ger, of the convert, I'm here. I cannot be dissuaded. You cannot push me away any longer. I am sticking with you. Baruch Zavka Ba. Okay, ba'asher tamusi amus, where you die, I will die. V'shame kaver, and there I will be buried. Ko ya'asa Hashem li v'chol yosif ki hamavet yafrid b'ni uveinacha. This is it. Only death will force us to part from one another. So Naomi sees that Ruth cannot be dissuaded, and she says, fine, you're in. Now, is an astonishing moment in light of the fact that Naomi communicates very, very clearly, yes, I was once a prominent woman, but now I am nothing. Look a few psukim later, Pasuk Chaf, Vatomer, this is when Ruth and Naomi actually enter the land of Israel. The Pasuk before says, Vayihi kavona beis lacham vatahom kol ha'ir. Everyone is astonished. They're gasping. This is Naomi. She's reduced to nothing. She's shriveled into this pauper in tatters and rags. And what does she say in Pasuk Chaf? What does Naomi respond to the murmurers around her? Vatomar alehen, al tikrena li Naomi. Don't call me Naomi pleasantness. Okay? From Ne'ima, from Ne'imot. Krena li mara. Call me bitterness. Alright, she changes her name right here from Naomi, pleasantness, happiness, to Mara, bitterness. Okay, so we all know from our own experiences in our own lives that we have better times in our life, we have worse times in our life. When we are at the nadir of our existence, when we're at the lowest point in our existence, and we're feeling the acute pain of our tsaras, we are not pleasant. We are not Ne'ima. We are not Naomi. Krena li mara. Call me bitterness. This is not a good time in my life. I don't exude a positive energy. No one wants to come near me. I don't really want anyone to come near me. This is a time for you to stay away. And yes, what does Ruth announces without a doubt in the midst of all these declarations by Naomi, I am just bitterness, Ruth Davka Ba. She says, I don't care if this is the darkest moment of your existence. I'm here and I am by your side and I am not going to abandon you in your darkest hour. And push me away as you might try, I'm not leaving you. Last week, rather randomly, but very fortuitously for this year, I happened to have been learning Shmuel Beis, and I came upon this incident in the life of David HaMelech that I found totally striking, because I had Ruth, Megillas Ruth, very fresh in my head. This Perek Tetzvav open. This is coming at the point in David HaMelech's life when his son Avshalom rebels against him. So essentially, we find David, Shruyan Batar. He is at the depths of his Sar, his own child, Absalom, has rebelled against him. What does David do? He gets up and he flees the palace. He sets up some refugee camp outside of the palace, you know, a couple miles away. He's lying and hiding. He's awaiting an attack by Absalom. Some of his closest advisors and friends have actually sided with Absalom. He is totally abandoned and utterly bereft of friends and family. What happens? There's this very tiny little episode in the midst of this mered of Absalom, this rebellion of Absalom, as follows. Pasuk Yitzes, Vayomer HaMelech El Itai HaGiti. Let me give you the background. A man named Itai HaGiti, who is a non-Jewish general and leader of a nation, of the Gitim, of these people, suddenly appears in the refugee camp of David HaMelech. And this was a former ally of David in a war that they had fought together, like an old political liaison of David who just suddenly, strangely, appears at the site where David is encamped. So, Vayomer HaMelech El Itai HaGiti, Lama Teilech, Kama Ta Itanu, why are you here? David says to him, what are you doing here? Okay, Shuv Vashiv, Im HaMelech Ki Nachri Ata. Go home. You're a non-Jew. This is not your issue. You don't have to be here. Ata v'gam gila ata l'mekomach. Gala ata l'mekomach. L'mekomcha. Okay? Basically, he's saying, what are you doing here? Okay? We can skip the next pasuk. It's the same thing. Pasuk chaf aleph. Vayan itai et hamelech vayomar. Chai Hashem v'chai adoni hamelech. I am swearing by God, I am swearing by you. Long live the king. Ki im b'makom asher yihyeh sham Adoni HaMelech, because where my master, you, David HaMelech, go, im l'mavet im l'chayim, for life or for death, if you are going to survive or if you're going to be killed, ki sham yihyeh avdecha. He submits himself totally and entirely to David. I will be for you a servant. Okay, so he sticks himself into this issue that's totally not his own, to a people that's totally not his own, and he tells David, you can't dissuade me, you can't push me away. I refuse to be daunted by the king himself dismissing me and punishing me and banishing me to go home. I am here for you. Okay, now, it's a magnificent instance of measure-for-measure reward that David HaMelech's grandmother, Ruth, this Nachriya, this non-Jewish woman, sits by the side of Naomi in her darkest hour, that later on in David HaMelech's life, he is zocha to such a strange friend, to such an astonishing element of dedication in his darkest hour. Okay. Now, we can only understand the level of greatness of this particular dveikus, or this particular sense of arevus, of feeling our responsibility for someone else's tzaras, okay, if we cast Ruth as a foil to Naomi and to Elimelech, or I should say, to the actions of Naomi before the opening of this Megillah, and to Elimelech in the only way we know him. Because, why do I say before, Naomi before? Because there's two Naomis. There's the Naomi who sinned before, and then there's this Naomi who has all of her tzaras. Actually, there are three Naomis. And then there's the third Naomi who does the tshuva, who hatches her plan, her great scheme, her great crazy scheme, but ultimately she redeems her name, her son's name, her husband's name, etc. So Naomi is, I actually give a separate share on Naomi. She's a magnificent character, and we have a lot to learn from Naomi, how she totally changes around her life. But the original Naomi that we meet is the Naomi who, with her husband Elimelech, abandoned Bnei Yisrael in the time of the famine. Why do we classically understand the punishment, the death of Elimelech, the death of the two sons? We understand it as a direct punishment for their having abandoned Klal Yisrael at this particular, you know, moment, pivotal moment in their history, and they lost their leader. Elimelech was considered a leader. Now, interestingly, you know what, let's read source number 6, the Yalkut Shimoni. Basically is a medrash that's commenting on why were they punished to such a drastic extent. Okay, So on the first line in the middle of the sentence, the words begin, V'lama ne'anash. And why were they punished? Lefi shehipil liban shel Yisrael. Because they, Naomi and Elimelech, disappointed and devastated, essentially, the hopes of Bnei Yisrael. And the Midrash actually goes on to compare them to the ambassadors or the emissaries of a king who is stationed in one of the outposts of his empire, whom all the people consider to be the leader. And when times get tough, clearly they're going to turn to their leader, the emissary of the king, to help them. And yet, what does the emissary do? He bolts. He can't stand the thought of having to save people. Okay? The second to last line after the comma, Kach Elimelech Migdolei Hadar. So too was Elimelech from the Gedolei Hadar, Umefarnesei Hadar, and he was one of the wealthiest men of this generation. Haya, V'kivan Shaba'u Shnei Ra'avon, but as soon as the years of famine set in, Amar Achshav Yihiyu Kol Yisrael Mesubin B'kupasan Al Pitri. Now, everybody's going to come knocking at the door, these annoying mashuachim. They're going to come with their kupos, with their tzedakah boxes. They're going to start begging me for food. I don't have to deal with this. This one comes with his pushka. This one comes with his basket. Ma'asa, what did he do? Amad ubarach mepneihem. He gets up and he bolts. He runs. Okay? So Rus's Dvikus is only so magnificent and so spectacular in direct contrast to the lack of Dvikus of Naomi and Elimelech. Incidentally, just as an aside, Naomi and Elimelech, both of them were from Shevet Yehuda. Shevet Yehuda, we know, ever since Yehuda lived, was the Shevet, the tribe of leaders. They were the Yehuda distinguished himself through his acts of initiative taking and leadership and sticking up for the little guy way back in the original encounter with Yosef. He defends Binyamin. Yehuda establishes himself clearly as the brother who is the greatest leader. And I actually give a separate shiur that traces the Davidic line starting from Yehuda all the way through David, tracing each one of these people's acts of leadership. Naomi's own grandfather was the one and only Nachshon ben Aminadav, the prince of the Shevet of Yehuda. Why is Nachshon so famous and familiar to us? He is the one Yid who stands on the banks of the Yam Suf at our Exodus, at our Yetzias Mitzrayim, and of the millions of people that were there, okay? He steps into the raging sea, the Yam Suf, and in the merit of his initiative taking and his emunah and his belief of leading the people, we are taught that we had the miracle of Kriyas Yam Suf. So this woman, Naomi's grandfather, is Nachshon ben Aminadav, but her response to tragedy, to panic, to crisis, is to run, is to abandon people. This is why they were punished. Why were they punished? This is why. They did not act true to their own family heritage, to their own ancestry, to their own inherent mida that was within them, this character trait of leadership. Okay. Now, source number 7, the Medrash Tanchuma, actually also repeats, it's also a commentary on why were they punished and what did they do wrong, and then it actually adds an element that the sons Machlon and Kilion should have learned from their father's mistakes, from Naomi and Elimelech. They should have learned. They shouldn't, as soon as Elimelech passed away, they should have returned with their mother back to Israel to face the music, to face the crisis, and to help out. But they didn't. They entrenched in their positions, and not only that, they married these Moabite women, Ruth and Arpa. Now, what I would like to point out is the last line on this page, okay, it says, V'shem ha'achas Arpa, the name of one was Arpa, shehafcha oref v'chamosa, because she turned her back, and oref is actually the nip of the neck, turned her back on her mother-in-law, v'shem ha'shenis Ruth. And the second one's name is describing these non-Jewish wives that the sons took. V'shem ha'shenis Ruth, shera'asa divrei chamosa. And why was the second one called Ruth? Because shera'asa divrei chamosa. She saw the divrei, the words, I'm translating literally right now, chamosa, her mother-in-law. Okay, very enigmatic, enigmatic phrase, okay? Ra'asa, how do you see someone's words? Generally, you hear someone's words. So what was specific about Ra'as? First of all, let me just back up for a minute. There is a school of thought, a philosophy, that all names in the Torah of people are actually metaphorical, they're symbolic for the essence of the character of the person being described, okay? So in this spirit, this analysis is conducted. Why do we call her Arpa? Because she turned her back. Why do we call her Rus? Because Ra'asa, she saw. Now, there are many other explanations for why her name was Rus. In fact, a very interesting one, a very nice one that I just saw yesterday, is that Rus in Gematria, the numerical value, the numerical equivalency of each of these letters that comprise her name, Resh Vav Taf, is 606. These were the additional 606 mitzvot that she accepts upon herself, in addition to the 7 mitzvot that she was obligated to do as a non-Jew to become a Jew. Okay? Beautiful, nice. This medrash is giving us a very enigmatic explanation of the name Ruth, because she saw the divrei of Naomi. Okay. So if we're going to translate ra'asa as saw, then we have to translate divrei differently. Okay, if we're going to say ra'asa as she heard, then she heard the voice, the words of Naomi. But let's retranslate this word divrei, and let's use something a little more colloquial and familiar. What did she see? She saw the degradation of Naomi. She saw through the words, through the articulated pain of Naomi, that this was a woman who needed someone to stand by her side. She didn't need to push people away from her. She needed a Ruth, and she gets her as such a phenomenal gift from Hashem. She gets this woman who refuses to leave her side. Okay. Now, definitely true that in our lives, if we find one person who can sort of see our divrei, our issues, so to speak, okay, who can really understand our issues so much and who gets it, who gets us, who sees precisely what we need, that this is a very, very unique and special type of a person. But that, in a sense, it's almost like a level one of what made Ruth so phenomenal, because we're not done. Ruth becoming the Imel Shel Malchus for all, you know, for eternality in the Jewish people, that's not it. That's not the only thing she did. That was not the only way in which she did a chesed. Because with Ruth, we're going to go one step further. Now, I will ask you to look at that supplementary, that supplementary source sheet, and we're going to see Perek Gimel, the numbers are given on the left-hand margin of this page, okay? What's happening now in the Megillah, just to give a broad overview, a brief overview, is the following. In Perek Aleph, we have this heart-wrenching exchange between Naomi and her daughters-in-law, Naomi declaring, I am broken, I am nothing, I have no hope, I am bitterness, leave me, Ruth. Arpa says yes, turns back. Ruth says no, I'm sticking with you. In Perek Beis, what we have is Ruth being still the very strong-willed young woman who's saying, don't start with me, don't set up with me, I'm here by your side, I'm not leaving you. And we still see Ruth in a very active, forceful role. We see her taking the initiative in practically the second pasuk of Perek Beis. What we see is Ruth saying, you know what? Now that we're here in Israel, I'm going to go out to the field and I'm going to collect sheaves of wheat for us. Okay? So, incidentally, please keep in mind that Ruth was of royal blood. So this, you know, non-Jewish princess is now not only sticking with Naomi, but she sticks it out. Okay? She comes, she plays the full part of being Naomi's friend. Being Naomi's friend, being Naomi's daughter now, means you have to be the poor person. You have to be the nebuchal in the field of the rich man collecting the droppings from his harvest. And she knows this. And she's fully willing to submit herself to this new role that she's taken on. So in Perek Beis, she is telling Naomi, I will go to the field and I will collect the food for us. But in Perek Gimel, we have a shift. And this is the third Na'ami that I briefly referenced before. Okay? In Perek Gimel now, Na'ami is sort of emerging from the stupor and the shock of her tzaras and her bitterness. Now Na'ami is starting to hatch a plan. Now the main actress in this story, Lahavdil, it really happens, but I'll just borrow these literary terms, okay? Now the main character becomes Na'ami, and we shift. Now Ruth becomes passive and submits herself to the will of Na'ami. This is the perek in which Na'ami hatches her plan, and frankly, her crazy plan, her insane plan that flies in the face of logic, of propriety, of halacha, of Yiddishkeit, of modesty, of tznius, makes absolutely no sense. Go to the, you, non-Jewish girl, you know what? Everyone's talking about you behind your back, but you. You go to the leader of the Jewish people, Boaz was the reigning shofet of the Jewish people. Go to him in the stealth of night, uncover his legs. Okay, this is a crazy plan by all accounts, by any logical reasoning. But we have this shift. And what is Naomi's response to this shift? Okay, what does she say? So let us look at Perek Gimel. V'tomer lo Na'omi chamosa, bili, halo ata avach shalom anoach asher yitav lach. Now Naomi is waking up. Now, incidentally, what makes her wake up? Ruth, it says in Perek Beis, that when Ruth decides I'm going to go and collect, she just happens to go to collect the wheat droppings in the field of Boaz, Vayikar Mikra, the language of coincidence is used. But Naomi is a religious and spiritual and holy woman. She realizes it is no mere coincidence that Hashem put you into the field of Boaz, our relative, the leader of the generation, and our relative who can deliver us a redemption. Okay, this is no coincidence. Okay, so suddenly this inspires Naomi and she wakes up. And she says, my daughter, I want to establish some peace for you. Okay? Pasuk Gimel. So she says, I want you to go to the, in Pasuk Beis, she says, I want you to go to the threshing floor. You know Boaz's schedule. You know when he's going to go to sleep. And Pasuk Gimel says, Virachat Vasach. Okay, I'm reading funny because there are a lot of very funny and strange things happening in this text. There is what we call a kri uktiv. It's written one way in the text of the Torah, but it's read another way. So in the right-hand margin, it's going to say, okay, first let's just review the simple meaning of these words. Virachat, I want you to go in the dark of night. I want you to wash. I want you to anoint yourself. I want you to put your clothes on you, okay? But simlosayach, your clothes, simlosacha, alayach, it's getting very confused here. The language is signaling to us problems. What's going on? We have to interpret this, okay? You're putting on your clothes, but you're putting on my clothes. Alayach, your clothes on me, put on your clothes to me, okay? Next. V'yaradeti is what is written. We read on the right-hand margin, v'yaradet. So suddenly there's a very, very bizarre slippage in the text. And I will go down, but really, and you will go down. Naomi is mapping out this plan for Ruth. And she's telling her, you're going to wash, you're going to anoint, you're going to get dressed, you're going to go down. But why is the text saying v'yaradeti and I will go down? What is going on here? Okay, and then again, Vishachavti. Later on, you'll see, look at the right-hand margin, Vishachavti, and then three words over, Vishachavti. And I will lie down next to Boaz. What's going on? Naomi is giving Ruth instructions. What's going on in this textual, linguistic slippage is that there is this utter collapse of the you and I difference. Okay, Naomi is so blessed to have this astonishingly dedicated daughter-in-law, this best friend that none of us in our lives ever had or that we should only hope to have and be zocha to have, okay, that she believes that Ruth is so dedicated to her life and to her problems that she will do even this crazy thing. She will enact this plan as if she is Naomi herself and for Naomi, on behalf of Naomi, Naomi whose line was cut off because of the sin of selfishness that she and her husband showed before. She so trusts and believes in Ruth as her friend that she will do this entirely for her, that there's this textual, there's this linguistic slippage of you and I. We are no longer separated one from another. But really, we are as if one and the same. Okay. But even more astonishing, that Naomi's reliance upon Ruth to be so dedicated to her mission, to Naomi's mission, is Naomi's response. And look at Pasuk. Hey. What is it? Vatomer Eleha, and Ruth said to Naomi, Kol Asher Tomri, blank space, E'eseh. Everything you tell me to do, E'eseh, I will do. Look at the right-hand margin. What is that blank space? How do we read it? Even though it's written with a blank space, we read it a lie. Vatomer Eleha kol asher tomri a lie e'eseh. All you say to me, I will do. So, of course, the Mefarshim go crazy here. Why is there a missing word in the middle of the text? And the answer is, according to the Igeres Shmuel, he gives this answer and other commentaries also, that in actuality, this is one little glitch in the relationship of Naomi and Ruth. That the missing Eli was symbolic of Ruth's actual hesitation. She thinks this plan is nuts. She thinks this plan is crazy. But, she submits her will to Naomi's will. She literally removes the Eli, the me-ness, from the husband. This is your tsar. This is your pain. I offer to stand by you, and I am going to help you on your terms. Not on my terms. Not on what I think is good for you. Not on what I think is good for us. There's no more us. There's just you. She literally negates and nullifies her own essence, her very essence. So it's one thing to have a friend who stands by you in your darkest moments, but it's altogether another madriga to have a friend who self-negates and who only helps you on the terms that you put out there. Okay. Look at source number 9. Actually, source number 8, I'm just using the expression Shekol Yisrael Arevim Zebazeh. It's in bold, okay? The expression Kol Yisrael Arevim Zebazeh, to my great shock, actually, when I originally prepared this shir, I looked all over for it, Bar Ilan CD, friends, Rabbanim, talked to lots of people. Actually, Kol Yisrael Arevim Zebazeh is an expression that means all of Israel is responsible one for the other. It has a very specific context. And this context is no different. It means, lehalacha, what are my obligations toward my fellow Jew who isn't fulfilling their halachic obligations, who isn't keeping mitzvot at the level to which they should. And there is a vast amount of halachic literature defining which mitzvot, how much I'm responsible, etc., etc. In fact, I once heard a shiur given by Rev Rosenzweig on this topic, Kol Yisrael Arevim Zebazeh, and I thought I'm going to walk in, I'm going to get a nice shiur like this type of style of shiur. And of course, it was 100% halachic, and of course, I understood maybe 25% because it was Rabbi Rosenzweig speaking. But basically, what I walked out with was a clear understanding that my understanding of Kol Yisrael Arevim Zebazeh is wrong. So, in the spirit of being wrong, I continue to share with you this halachic concept that I am now applying more socially, more psychologically, more emotionally, that we are all responsible for one another. And in fact, I do have rabbinic source for this. Rav Hirsch, Rav Shamsher and Follow Hirsch, has a magnificent essay on tzibur, on the concept of what is a tzibur. And he, too, just throws out this expression, Yisrael Arevim Zebazeh. So, in the spirit of Rav Shamsher and Follow Hirsch, we understand more loosely, more generally, the term arevus, not to mean a halachic sense of obligation, but rather a social sense of obligation, a sense of responsibility that we are connected to each other and we have to be connected to each other, that your pain is my pain and my pain is your pain, and that there is no you and I, there's an us. I once heard a beautiful story about a Rav whose wife had a tumor in her leg. And he and his wife went to the doctor, and he walked into the doctor, and he said to the doctor, "Doctor, our leg is hurting us." Okay, that is what we're talking about. There's no you and I in this equation. It's us. It's what we feel. Now, source number 9, Shailos and Tshuvos of Chassam, so far, also, I'm sort of decontextualizing the source from a different discussion altogether. A related discussion, but somewhat tangential to what we're talking about. He is talking about the efficacy of prayer on someone else's behalf. Okay, he's saying, how is it possible that I can pray for someone else's din v'cheshvon? If someone else is diagnosed with this tumor, how can my tefillos really help this person? Okay, and incidentally, another source, maybe more familiar to you than Shailos and Tshuvos of Chassam so far, is the Sefer Hagyone Halacha, his Ma'amar on Rosh Hashanah. His chapter on Rosh Hashanah, I believe it's the first Sefer Hagyone Halacha, he asks the same question. He's like, how is it effective for me to daven for someone else's diagnosis? And his answer, and the answer of the Chassam so far, and a very common answer, is this concept of what your diagnosis, my diagnosis, it's our diagnosis. Our foot hurts us. Okay, our foot is hurting. So if someone is diagnosed with an illness, we are all diagnosed with the same. If you stub one finger, you don't say, you're not concentrating on the 9 other fingers that are feeling good at that moment. All of your concentration is focused on your stubbed toe or your stubbed finger. That's how we have to consider each other, that we're all connected, we're all part of one guf. And that's what the Chassam Sofer is using, this metaphor that we see actually all throughout rabbinic literature, that B'nai Yisrael is considered like a single unit, a single human body. And when one finger, everyone should be concentrated on the hurt and on the pain and on the agony of that one branch, of that one person, of that one finger of our common body. Okay. Now, if we compare the unbelievable selflessness of Ruth, if we think, consider the unbelievable selflessness of Ruth in comparison to one of the original biblical historical figures, Cain, we see Ruth as a foil to Cain in an astonishing way. Look at source number 10 in Bereishis. Let's review for a minute before we look at source number 10. Cain is the son of Adam and Chava. Cain has a brother named Hevel. Hevel gives a sacrifice to Hashem, which is accepted and lauded. Cain gives a sacrifice to Hashem, which is rejected. Cain is enraged. He is jealous. And he essentially gets rid of, he murders Hevel. Okay? Who is Hevel to Cain? It's not his brother. It's not his Achi, his brother, Hashem Arachi Anochi, is what he's going to say. He doesn't care. He's Hevel. He's a nothing. He's a nobody to him. He is someone to be disposed, a neighbor who's in the way. Okay? So Hashem comes to Cain in Pasuk Tet and says, Vayomer Hashem al Cain, I Hevel Achicha, and Hashem says to Cain, where is Hevel, your brother? Vayomer, and he responds, Lo Yadati, I don't know. Hashem Arachi Anochi, am I my brother's keeper? Pasuk Yud, Vayomer, and Hashem says, Me'asisa, what have you done? Kol demei achicha so'akim elai min ha'adama. The shrieking voice of your brother is heard to me. It's screaming to me from beneath the ground that you buried him in. Don't you dare dismiss him as a mere hevel, a nothingle. He is your brother. Incidentally, the word elai is here. Okay, the word Eli is missing in Megillas Ruth Paragimel, Pasuk Hey. I'm just throwing that out there. Maybe I'll figure it out. I haven't figured it out yet, but okay. So, Eli, and me, who is this me? Okay, this is not the Ruth me, this is the ultimate me, this is me, God, this is the God me. This is the biggest Eli that ever was in the history of the Tanakh, Eli. Okay, now, what I'd like to do before we end is briefly retell a story that I think illustrates what we've been talking about very, very well. I heard this story originally on a CD by Neshama Kalbach, so I apologize in advance because I am not nearly the storyteller that Neshama Kalbach is. And I recommend that you buy this CD if only to hear this story being told by Neshama Kalbach. Whatever about the music, it's good. But anyway, this is the story. tells the story of two Rabbanim, two great Rabbanim, the Volker Rebbe and the Kutka Rebbe. They were best friends. And the Volker Rebbe passes away. And the Kutka Rebbe is waiting for some sort of communication from his best friend, the Volker Rebbe, up in Shemayim, to tell him, I'm okay. Essentially, he's waiting for a postcard. All is good here. Heaven is good. He does not get this postcard. He does not get this communication. A week goes by, a month goes by, several weeks go by, and he's getting very nervous. Where is my friend, the Volker Rebbe? Why isn't he communicating with me? So he decides, if the Volker Rebbe isn't coming to me, I'm going to the Volker Rebbe. So he takes himself up to Shemayim, and he sees the first palace, the palace of Avraham Avinu, and he runs up to it, and he shakes the gate, and he enters the palace, and he runs up to Avraham Avinu, and he says, where is my best friend, the Volker Rebbe? Have you seen him? And Avraham Avinu says, the Volker Rebbe? Oh, he was here, but he left. So the Kutka runs out of this palace, and he runs to the next palace, the palace of David HaMelech. And he says to David HaMelech, where is my best friend, the Volker Rebbe? Have you seen him? I can't find him. The Volker, he was here, but I don't know, he left. So he runs to the palace of Rashi. Same story. So he runs out into heaven and he sees a malach and he says to the malach, where is my best friend, the Volker Rebbe? And the malach says, oh, the Volker? He was here, but if you want to find him, you have to travel through that very deep, dark forest over there. Beyond the forest, you will find the Volker Rebbe. So the Kutka has no choice. He wants to find the Volker Rebbe and understand what is going on. So he treks through this horrible forest, this creepy, eerie, scary forest. And beyond the forest, he hears this ocean. And the ocean, he never heard waves screaming like this, roaring waves. And he sees this little speck of a figure, all in black, and he recognizes his best friend, the Volker Rebbe. So he runs over to the Volker Rebbe, and he says, what are you doing here? And the Volker Rebbe says to the Kutzker, do you see this ocean? And he says, yes. Do you recognize this ocean? He says, no, what is this ocean? And the Volker Rebbe says, this is the ocean of tears. The tears of Bnei Yisrael. And I vowed to Hashem that I would not leave the side of this ocean until he dries it up. What is the point of this magnificent Hasidic tale? What are we learning? Now, frankly, I don't know who the Volker Rebbe is. I'm guessing you don't know who the Volker Rebbe is, but what we know from this story is that this is a man who probably dedicated his entire life while he was here in this world to davening to Hashem for the downtrodden, for the Nebuchad, for those who were Shruyin Basar, who were totally embittered by all of their tzaras. This is a story of a man who goes up to Shemayim. You'd think he dedicates his whole life to this work. He'd retire, but he doesn't retire. There's no R&R in store for the Volker Rebbe. He rejects the comforts of the palace. He finds the dark forest. He finds the ocean that has the roaring waves of the tears of the Jews. He's still fighting. He's still davening. He's still standing by Bnei Yisrael, Klal Yisrael, his brothers who are screaming in agony. Kol demei achicha so'akim elai min ha'adama. He's up there, but he hears the shrieking of the tzaras and the agony on earth below. What is the point of this story of the Volker Rebbe? This is the story of Ruth HaMoaviyah, who becomes Ima Shel Malchus. This is the story of Megillat Ruth. A non-Jewish girl. It wasn't her issue. It wasn't her in her life story. She could have turned back to the luxury of the palace that was in store for her, that was rightfully her own. Naomi said, go home. Go be your royal self. Go reinvent your life. What do you need my agony for? But she is undaunted, and she faces the forest, and she takes the trek with Naomi, and she goes into the ocean with the screaming waves, the murmurs. Who is this non-Jewish girl? Who is this Moabite girl? Look at Naomi. Vatehom, they are astonished. Look at Naomi. Krenali Mara. She accompanies the bitterness. She had the lure of royalty, of luxury, of the comfort of her existence holds nothing for her. She is not afraid to take this journey to the agony. She goes and she stands by Naomi. How many of us also go through an experience, a terrible experience, an experience of pain and sorrow with other people, but those other people make it a cross. They cross the borderline. They're finished with this tsar, but they forget. They forget what it's like. The Volker Rebbe didn't forget. He, in the lap of his luxury, still finds a way to remember. What Rus knew and what the students of Rabbi Akiva knew, didn't know, was that the Torah is meaningless if it doesn't come along with Chesed. It is no mistake that Chazal paired up Chag HaShavuot, Zman Matan Torah Seinu, the holiday of Shavuot when we receive the Torah, with the Megillah of Rus. Not Echa, not Kohelet, not Shir HaShirim, but Rus. What are they telling us? What is the message? The message is that, yes, Man Matan Torah Seinu, there are the mitzvot and there's the Torah, but there's Megillah Rus. If you don't have the Megillah Rus with the Torah is meaningless. And the proof is the death of these great Talmidei Chachamim, the students of Rabbi Akiva. You can be the greatest Talmid Chacham in the world, but if you are not a sensitive person, if you are not a Baal Chassid, your Torah knowledge amounts to nothing. In fact, in the case of Rabbi Akiva's students, it amounted to death. Rus knew that in one hand, there's the Rus, the Reish Vav Tav, the 606 mitzvot plus the 7 mitzvot, the Torah that she has to keep. But in the other hand is the Megillat Chassid. That is what Rus knew, and the students of Rabbi Akiva did not know. Look at our last verse, number 11. In Shemos, Parshas Yisroel, it describes the moment that Bnei Yisrael were about to receive the Torah. Vayesu me'Refidim, and they traveled from Refidim, vayavo midbar Sinai, and they came to the midbar Sinai, vayachanu ba'midbar, and they encamped in the midbar. Vayichan sham Yisrael neged ha'har. And he encamped there, Yisrael, in front of the mountain. Again, linguistic confusion, what is going on? Vayachanu is a plural usage, and they encamped in the Midbar, as opposed to Vayichan Sham. First of all, it's repetitious. We were just told they encamped. Second of all, why is this switching? It's from plural to singular, and he encamped there. What does Rashi tell us in source number 12? Vayichan Sham Yisrael. What does this mean? Ki ish echad b'lev echad. As one body, as one unit, our foot hurts us. Okay? Aval sha'ar hachaniyot b'tarumas v'machlokas. The vayachanu means that the rest of their encampments were with politics, right? With politics. But this encampment, neged ha'har, in front of the har, was totally and completely unified. What was different about this particular encampment in the 40 years of traveling through the Midbar? This was the encampment Erev Chag Shavuot, Erev Zman Matan Torah Seinu. On the eve of receiving the Torah, Bnei Yisrael is teaching us that we cannot receive the Torah if we do it b'tarum asum b'machlokas. There are no politics. There is no division. There is no you. There is no I. There is just ish echad b'lev echad. We have to be like one in order to receive the Torah. Ruth was a brilliant woman. She studied her Torah very well. She knew this pasuk by heart. She understood, yes, Ruth reish vav tav, I have to have Torah in one hand, but if I don't have the Megillah Chesed in the other hand, I'm not going up that mountain. I cannot be Mekabel, the Torah. There is no Yiddishkeit in store for me. Kabbalah HaTorah means that it's Torah and Halacha, but it's also Chesed. Rabbi Akiva's students only had one and not the other, and they never made it to Shavuot, to Zman Matan Torah Seinu. They died along the way. For us, this Shavuot, we are lucky, because just as Ruth got lucky, then Naomi mapped out the plan for her, told her exactly what to do, this crazy harebrained scheme, she listened, she does it, fine. She got lucky that someone mapped it out for her, we got lucky because Ruth mapped it out for us. And we know that the way we are going to ascend the mountain this Shavuot is going to be with the Torah in one hand and with the Megillah Chesed in the other hand. In the one hand, we're going to have the Na'amis, the great somebodies who are embittered and full of tsar and tsaris. We're not going to be afraid to hold their hands. We're not going to be afraid to stand by their side. And in the other hand, we're going to have the Hevels, the nobodies, the nothings that we just look through, that otherwise we dispense with. Holding on to both hands of this unit of Klal Yisrael, we too will ascend the mountain. Thank you.